This is the fourth one of a series that I've been trying to do on. It's called Reinhold Niebuhr and His Critics, and I don't know if any of you have been here for some of the other ones. I see a few familiar faces. So this is the fourth one of those in those series, and it should make some sense by itself, but it builds a little bit on some of the things that we've been talking about in the other sessions. So some things aren't clear. You know, we'll try to clear them up as we go along. I want to say something about the title. When you come up here to be a teacher, one of the things you get is a letter from Elmer Witt, and he tells you about, he says, one of the things that's real important up here is you got to think of witty titles so that you can lure people into these things. So this was my attempt at a witty title. It comes, I think, from My Fair Lady. Isn't there a song of My Fair Lady where I don't know if it's Henry Higgins or a bunch of his friends are sitting around, you know, saying, why can't a woman be more like a man? Well, this one says, why can't a woman be less like a man? And what I really mean to say by that, I guess, is that why can't people recognize that in some fundamental ways, and this is the assumption that I'm starting off with, in some fundamental ways, even though there are a lot of things about men and women that are alike, women experience the world in different ways than men do. And that has some theological implications. And that's what I want to talk about. And I don't want to talk about whether or not that's a cultural kind of thing or whether it's biological or, you know, why that is. I guess I just, you know, there's a wealth of studies and there's more being done all the time that say that there's some ways that men experience the world that are different from the ways that women experience the world. And that's kind of what I want to build on today. So that's kind of the starting assumption, and that's what the title's all about. And what it is it's a critique of Reinhold Niebuhr's theology by some feminist theologians who criticize him at just that point. Now, building on some of the things that we've said earlier in the week, I think it's probably safe to say that Reinhold Niebuhr is, if not the most influential North American theologian, one of the most influential North American theologians in the 20th century. It seems like whether you agree with him or not, you got to deal with him. Now, the 20th century is not over, so who knows, you know, in 2000, what we'll say about him, but I think he's pretty significant anyway. And it's probably clear by now that I personally believe that there's a lot about his thought and his ideas that's worth recovering. He had a lifelong commitment to theological and political thought, and I think it can shed a great deal of light on the current discussions that we're having regarding religion and politics. That was big in the last election. I think it's going to be even bigger in the next election. That's why I think Niebuhr is somebody that we ought to pay attention to. But after you said all that about him, obviously, his thought is hardly above criticism. I mean, he wasn't perfect, and he wouldn't have claimed to be either. And he wouldn't expect it from him, because he was one of these people, a basic tenet of all of his thought was self-criticism. You know, he said that you have to be self-critical about your ideas, and you have to be able to put forward your ideas, but you always have to keep examining them to see where the holes are. So you could do that from a couple different ways, I suppose. You could probably compare the ideas of Reinhold Niebuhr with Lutheran theology. Although they're pretty close, there probably are some differences. I haven't done that. You could compare him with the ideas of liberation theology, and that's something I want to do a little bit tomorrow. You could compare him from the tradition of what I would call the Radical Reformation tradition, the pacifist tradition, and I want to do that a little bit tomorrow. Some of you may be familiar with a book by Yoder called The Politics of Jesus. Yoder's a Mennonite, and he disagrees with Reinhold Niebuhr in some real significant ways, and I want to talk a little bit about that tomorrow. But the other way you could criticize his theology, or at least take a look at it and show where the holes are, is from the perspective of women theologians, from feminist theologians. And that's what I want to do a little bit of today. So that's kind of what this is all about. Now, feminist theologies, women theologians, I think, are some of the most exciting and probably the most threatening, for me personally, in some ways, and the most creative kinds of theologies going on the theological scene today. And I'm not familiar with a whole lot of them. Some of you may be more familiar with feminist theology than I am. I'm only really familiar with one major feminist critique of Niebuhr's theology, and that's one I referred to earlier in the week. That's this book by Judith Plaskow called Sex, Sin, and Grace. And that's what I'm going to be relying on a little bit today. If some of you know more about this, share after I get done. When you talk about feminist theologies and a lot of the liberation theologies, one of the things that they emphasize a lot, let's see if I can move this out of the way, is the role of experience, human experience in theology. Now, feminist theologies not only say that experience is important in theology, what they say is human experience is the primary object that you reflect on, and it's also the primary source of revelation. You know, God reveals God's self to us through human experience. And it's also the criterion of truth. If you make a statement and it doesn't measure up according to human experience, then you can't really make that statement as a true statement. Now, that may make a lot of sense as we're sitting here talking, but it's really got some kind of revolutionary implications because in some ways it's a real departure from the way we traditionally think about theology. Classically, in the old days, and probably the way a lot of us grew up, we don't say that theology begins with experience. We say that theology begins with what we call revelation, scripture, you know, the tradition of the church, that kind of thing. Feminist theology kind of starts off with experience and then looks at revelation. And I'm going to put revelation in quotes. Okay, so that's kind of turning things around a little bit. And I got kind of a long quotation here from a really important book in feminist theology by Rosemary Ruther. Some of you may be familiar with it. It's called Sexism and God Talk. Has anybody ever read that book or know of it or anything? It's a rather significant book, and I suppose it's now out in paperback. And I suppose that, I mean, that's one way to judge a significant book, if they sold enough of the hard copy to bring it out in paperback. Anyway, one of the things she talks about in there, she says, it's frequently been said that feminist theology draws on women's experience as the basic source of content as well as a criterion of truth. And she says there's been a tendency to treat this principle of experience as unique to feminist theology. Okay, that's what I just got done saying, I guess, that it's unique. Or perhaps to liberation theologies. But she says this seems to be a misunderstanding of the experiential base of all theological reflection. What have been called the objective sources of theology, that is, revelation, are that scripture and tradition are themselves codified collections of human experience. So what she's saying is even though feminists say that they're going to start with experience instead of revelation, the people who say they're starting with revelation instead of experience are really starting from experience as well, but they're starting with somebody else's experience rather than the people who are contemporary right now. Revelation is other people's religious experience, not necessarily ours. Okay, and what she's trying to make a case for is the fact that what you need to do with this revelation is you need to test it out on the basis of experience, on the basis of what happens to you. Now, that's a pretty significant kind of thing, because that's not usually the way most of us are used to thinking about scripture and tradition. We usually think of this as being pretty objective. You know, that's God's word to us. What she's saying is she's saying, you know, that's the way God revealed God's self to some folks in Israel at the time of Jesus and in the early church through their experience. And it got written down and codified, but it's still experience. And we have to constantly test it out against our experience. Okay? Now, and she has some real interesting things to say about that, which I'll go on with later on. She says, you know, there's a reason why people who start with revelation instead of experience start with revelation, because one of the things you can do when you start there is you can sort of lock in the status quo. In other words, if you have an objective source of revelation that says that certain people are going to be in charge of things, and certain people are going to be some people are going to be the masters, and some people are going to be the obedient ones. You know, they have a vested interest in making you and I think that was revelation rather than experience. Okay, and that's a kind of a significant sort of thing. She says the problem with our revelation in the Christian tradition is that it's been based mostly on experience, but it's been based on a certain kind of experience. Can anybody guess whose experience it's been based on?
Man's
experience. See, I didn't need to tell you that. You knew. It's been based on men's experience rather than women's experience. And she says that's a really significant kind of thing. And one of the things that feminist theology is about is trying to get people to take seriously women's experience as well as men's experience. Now, that was something that was really important for Reinhold Niebuhr, too. Not necessarily taking women's experience seriously, but taking experience seriously. One of the books that I referred to earlier in the week by Dennis McCann, McCann says this about Reinhold Niebuhr. He says, however vague or ill-defined Christian faith for Niebuhr always served as an ultimate norm for ordering his various commitments. But his sense of faith, okay, his sense of faith was not some dogmatic absolute removed from the vicissitudes of history. As he later came to recognize, it was related in a kind of a circular fashion to the facts of experience. Thus, what he knew personally as the truth of his experience had to be trusted as the guide to theology. So he used his experience as a way of tempering what his theological principles were, and he kind of moved in a circle, kind of in the same way that Rosemary Luther is talking about. Okay? Okay, so at least at that point, there's at least a little convergence between Reinhold Niebuhr and feminist theologians like Rosemary Luther. So they've got something in common. They take experience seriously, and they're right up front about that. Okay, but the feminist critique of Niebuhr's theology deals with the way in which Reinhold Niebuhr handled experience, and there's three things wrong with it, according to feminist theologians. The first one is, his experience tended to be restricted to that of a North American male who had a lot of power, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. He dealt with people who were powerful people, and they were men for the most part. Okay, that's the first point. The second point is that as a result of that, he tended to generalize from those people that he was dealing with who were men of power that was a particular group of people with a particular set of experiences. But what he did was he generalized from that and he kind of made some universal statements about human nature as if to say that what was true for that particular group of powerful men was true for everybody everywhere. So he didn't just talk about that as men's experience, he talked about that as everybody's experience. His books were about human nature, okay? And that's pretty significant to move from that particular to that kind of a general kind of a basis. So that's the second thing. As a result of that, his theology becomes rather distorted because he ignored a lot of other people's experiences. North American women's experiences, people who didn't have a lot of power, people who weren't real intelligent, people who lived in parts of the world that weren't as prosperous as the United States, for instance. Those were kinds of experience that he really didn't take into account when he was talking about human nature. And so it left some holes in his theology. And those are the ones that feminist theologians point out. So what he did was he tended to emphasize some parts of his thought at the expense of others because he didn't take into account these other kinds of experience. Does that make some sense so far? Okay. Second thing, Niebuhr's experience, like most people's, tends to be his own experience. You know, when we're talking about experience, what do we relate most readily to? We relate to our own experience, okay? Experience is very particular. You know, it's my experience or my group's experience, and it has a perspective on reality. You know, I have a particular view of how the world works and how people relate to one another and how life is. But it's from my perspective, you know, that old story about the blind men trying to describe the elephant, you know, how that one works, you know, some grabs the leg and says it's a tree trunk, you know, and one grabs the tail and says it's nose, it's a snake, and somebody grabs an ear and says, what, it's a big leaf or something, you know the story, okay? Everybody's got a different kind of a perspective on the truth. And that's both the strength and the weakness. As a theological category of experience, because when we talk about experience, we can talk about our own experience, but it's kind of hard for us to talk about, to generalize from that, about everybody else's experience. Now, McCann, in that book that I referred to earlier, he says if you did a psychological profile on the people that Niebuhr was talking about, it would probably suggest that he was concerned with the aggressive personality and its problems. One of the things he assumes about people is that they have a high level of vitality and they have an almost spontaneous tendency to think and act in their own self-interests. Okay? His human nature, in short, is an active, dynamic self. active, kind of like he was. Active, dynamic, vital, smart. You know, he had a tendency to really be active. That was the way Niebuhr was, and that was what he said about human beings. And because his problem tended to be that of pride and forgetting his own limits, he tended to think that that was everybody's problem, okay? He says, perhaps it was a model of a successful American of his day. For the most part, Niebuhr's counsels seek to channel constructively the force of this type of personality by challenging this active, dynamic person to adopt a measure of self-restraint, okay, and an attitude of self-criticism. Humility and sacrificial love, these are commended as the resources of Christian faith for social action. So he's dealing with all of these real active, vital, smart, but relatively powerful people, and he's saying, you folks got to back off a little bit. You know, that you're too proud. You're too, you don't pay enough attention to your limits. You know, that was true of the people that he was talking to. McCann says, no doubt Niebuhr's diagnosis has the ring of truth for most of his North American readers. You know, when I first read Niebuhr, I read his book, The Nature and Destiny of Man, and I said, yeah, when he talks about people, he's talking about me. When he talks about sin, he's talking about my problem. You know, I could really relate to what he was talking about. But McCann goes on and he says, recent psychological studies suggest that persons suffering the effects of oppression, okay, these aren't the kind of people that Niebuhr's talking to now, these are people suffering the effects of oppression, they tend to react submissively to their situation. Typically, their aggression is directed not against the people who are oppressing them, but they direct it at themselves. You go on to an Indian reservation and you run into some of the highest rates of suicide anywhere in the United States. And you run into a lot of those kinds of aggression that's directed not at the people that are oppressing them, but at themselves. Okay, that tends to be the problem of people who are oppressed. That's not Niebuhr's person that he's talking to, but that's a reality. Thus, the oppressed may have to overcome some kind of moral paralysis more often than the self-righteousness emphasized by Niebuhr. It's not going to do much good to go and talk to somebody who's on the brink of suicide about the fact that they're too self-righteous. You know, that's not their problem at that moment in life. He says, if this is true, then it's not surprising that many social activists find Reinhold Niebuhr's realism stifling and an opportunity for indifference rather than responsibility. Remember, Niebuhr was talking to people that had a lot of energy, a lot of vitality, a lot of smarts, and a lot of power. He wasn't talking to people who were sort of oppressed and downtrodden. Those people didn't have to worry about self-righteousness and pride and worrying about their limits. Their whole life was limited. They didn't have any choices. Their aggression was not directed at other people. It was directed at themselves. So what he's saying doesn't make a whole lot of sense for them. Now, the place I want to go with that is to relate that to what Judith Plasko says in her book Sex, Sin, and Grace. She really tries to make the same point that Dennis McCann was making. She says, most women's experience does not allow for pride, self-righteousness, and aggressive behavior. Most women's experience allows for just the opposite of that. Many women's lives are characterized by low self-esteem, aggression that's directed at themselves rather than at other people. They need to become selves, as McCann says. They need to be the kind of selves that Niebuhr was worried. You know, he was dealing with people who were selves. But a lot of women, according to Judith Plasko, don't have that sense of self. And pride and self-righteousness and aggression is not their problem. And yet Niebuhr thought that that was everybody's problem because he was basing that on his experience and the people that he dealt with. Okay? Pride and self-righteousness is generally not the problem of women, according to Judith Plasko. Now, Niebuhr's problem is not that he didn't accurately reflect genuine human experience. I mean, he really did. He was honest and accurate, I think, when he described the people he was dealing with. His problem was that he assumed because the people he was dealing with were that way, everybody was that way, and he could make generalizations about human nature on that basis. He did what we call, he universalized the particular. He took a particular group of people and a particular experience, and he made these universal generalizations about it. That was what his problem was. And he tended to neglect all of these other areas of experience, like women's experience, as Judith Plasko would say. I quoted that thing from Robert McAfee Brown the other day, who says somewhere, what you see depends on where you stand, and what you hear depends on who you listen to. It's real hard to make those kinds of generalizations, depending on who you're talking to and who you're listening to. His theology accurately reflects his own experience and that of the people that he spent time with, the men that he spent time with. They were men of influence, we talked about in church, in the academy. They were men of influence in political life. He was a person that helped to formulate foreign policy. What he failed to recognize was the limits of that experience. He failed to recognize the fact that not everybody gets to formulate foreign policy. In fact, a lot of people don't get to formulate foreign policy, some people who would like to. There's an interesting critique of that. I talked about that biography of Niebuhr by Richard Fox, and there's a real interesting article in one of the Christianity in Crisis that's over in the reading room. I can't remember which issue it is, but it's the second issue that's got all the Niebuhr stuff in it. Anyway, it's written by a woman named Beverly Harrison, and she says, not only was that Niebuhr's problem, but that's Richard Fox's problem, too. She likes the book, but she says, Fox fails to recognize the fact that Niebuhr's experience really was Niebuhr's experience and not necessarily everybody's experience. I'm going to stop there and make a little aside. I think that's a point that preachers ought to heed real well. Most of us learn in the seminary that pride and self-righteousness in all of their manifest forms are the kinds of sin that people come into the congregation with, and those are the kind of things, that's the problem that people have, and the gospel is the solution to that. Well, that might not be the problem for the whole congregation. If in fact pride and self-righteousness is not the problem for a lot of women, but in fact it's just the opposite, then maybe the good news that we think applies to everybody there really doesn't apply to women. And a lot of people just kind of check out and say, well, that may be true for some people, but it surely isn't true for me. There was an interesting article in the Portland paper the day before we came up here on a phenomenon that some of you may be familiar with called woman church. And what it is it's a number of Catholic women who are just getting so frustrated by the patriarchal male domination of the Catholic Church that they're just checking out. And they're starting their own kind of a church because it doesn't make sense for them to be there anymore. And I think that's the result of not paying attention and not taking seriously women's experience. So there's really some important kinds of things that need to be paid attention to in terms of this discussion. There's a good book over in the bookstore, Gravity and Grace by Joseph Sittler. Maybe some of you have seen the book. And Joseph Sittler's got some great stuff in that book to say about experience. Let me just quote one of them because it's worth listening to in context of this particular discussion. He says, we ought not to permit the meaning of the term experience to be confined within the brackets of one's own existence. The meaning of experience is a poor and haggard thing if it refers only to what has happened to me. The meaning of education and culture is that we live vicariously a thousand other lives. All that has happened to human beings, things that have been recorded not by my experience, but by the experience of others, becomes a second life and a third and so on. Sittler says, I'm annoyed by those who define experience by saying, well, I haven't met it yet, it hasn't happened to me, therefore it has no authority. I would be a poor person if the only things I knew were what I have found out for myself. And then he goes on to expand on that. But that's a beautiful kind of a idea in terms of what we're talking about right here. Experience is something that's particular to people, and you've got to be real careful when you make generalizations on the basis of your own experience, which I think you could safely say that a lot of theology does on the basis of men's experience. Okay, because Niebuhr's thought reflected his own experience, in this case, the experience of a North American male who was used to smart people and powerful people, and he tended to universalize that experience in creating a picture of human nature. His theology, because of that, tends to overemphasize some elements which speak to men's rather than women's experience. When he says the problem that people have is pride and self-righteousness, he's right about half of his audience, but he's not right about the other half. And so when he talks about grace, which is the answer to sin, he only answers half the problem. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense for the other part of his audience. Now, Plasko, in that book that I referred to, Sex, Sin, and Grace, gives a rather extensive treatment of this problem. And it's a book I really recommend you take a look at if you're interested in this. But I just want to use one example. In her opening chapter, she describes what she means by women's experience. She gives some meaning to that. She describes a character by the name of Martha who appears in a number of Doris Lessing novels. Now, I'm not familiar with Doris Lessing, but are some of you familiar with her and familiar with Martha? Martha is a character that goes through about four novels, and that's part of what Plasko is talking about. She's in a series of novels, and apparently when you read about her, what Plasko says, her life is characterized by a failure to take responsibility for herself, a failure to make decisions at crucial points in her life. She kind of drifts along, and she lets other people make up her mind for her. She never does anything. She never takes the responsibility for the possibilities in her life, but she always allows herself to be limited by other people's choices. Maybe that's the way Niebuhr would say it. The way Niebuhr would say it is that Martha fails to live up to her possibilities. She's so overcome by the limits that other people are always putting on her that she never really tries to break out of that until the end of the novel. And that's what Plasko says is the problem of a lot of women in the United States. She says several pages earlier, she says, the central dilemma in women's lives is that women do not shape their own experience. They allow their life choices to be made for them by other people. Okay? Human beings are both creatures of the natural world, according to Reinhold Niebuhr. Contrast that summary of women's experience with Niebuhr's understanding of human nature. He says, human beings are both creatures of the natural world, and they're free from some of the constraints of the natural world. So they've got limits, but they've got possibilities. And sin, for Niebuhr, falls into two categories. And let me put them up here. The first kind of sin is the sins he calls the denial of the limits, you know, failure to deny the limits. Okay, and those are the sins of pride. Okay, we've got limits, but we fail to admit that we've got limits, and we keep overstepping our bounds all the time, and it gets us in trouble. He says, but there's another kind of sin, and he says that's the denial of our possibilities, the denial of our freedom as human beings, and he calls those sins of sensuality. Now that's not a very good choice of words in my estimation, because it makes it sound like those are sins of the body, you know, and you get all of this sexual, sensual kinds of stuff, and that's not what he's talking about there. What he's talking about there is allowing yourself to be limited. Instead of striving to reach your possibilities, you allow yourself to be limited, and you don't do anything. It's too hard to be free, so I'm just going to let other people make up my mind for me. That's a sin of sensuality, according to Niebuhr. But as he goes along in his theology, he really doesn't pay very much attention to these. He deals with these sins here, and his solution is to these sins up here. He really never develops this part of his theology. Because the people that he was talking to and the people that he was with really didn't have a problem with ignoring their freedom. What they had a problem with is ignoring their limits. And so he tended to overemphasize this part and really not say much about these, what he called sins of sensuality. And the reason he never talks about it is probably because he never had to deal with it himself. Okay? And he never knew anybody that really did. Now, that's probably overstating it, but this is where his interests lie, not here. According to Judith Plasko, though, ignoring the limits, pride, self-interest are not women's primary problem. She says, rather, the sins of sensuality, these down here, are more closely related to women's experience. She says, it would not be surprising, therefore, if the particular sin of women were the adoption of society's view of themselves to the detriment of their freedom. You know, allowing other people to say what women ought to be and how they ought to act and all that other kind of stuff, allowing society to limit them and not fighting against them. It would not be surprising, she says, in other words, if sensuality and not pride were the primary female sin. And she goes on to explain that. She says, the imposition of the status of other upon women represents the external dimension of their predicament. Insofar as women accept this status for its rewards and welcome relief from the burden of freedom, they are guilty of complicity in their own oppression. They sin. You know, they're not into pride. They're into sensuality, as Niebuhr defines it. Okay? since Niebuhr never deals with women's experience, or he has a small section in The Nature and Destiny of Man about it, but he really never deals with it very much. He never really emphasizes this side of his theology. Where was I?
It's sort of like me.
You know, I used to like to play basketball, but I never had a left hand. And you really need to develop your left hand so that when somebody's guarding you, they don't sit on your right hand. You can go either way, right? I never could go to the left, and so people used to guard me by standing right over here if the basket's there, and I never could do anything about it. Niebuhr sort of developed his right hand and never went for his left hand here, or left or right, depending on your right or left handed. You know, it's there, but it's underdeveloped. And if it was developed, I think it might speak a little more realistically to women's experience. That's what Plaskow thinks. Now, she thinks he's got some other problems, but that's the major one. Okay. So, I guess what I'm trying to say is that there's some resources available in Niebuhr's theology. Because he doesn't ever pay any attention to women's experience, he never develops those resources. That might make some sense. So what do I want to say in conclusion, and then we can talk about this. Robert McAfee Brown says that Niebuhr's most important contribution from the 1980s may be his consistent recognition of the need for self-criticism. What is often overlooked, he says, especially by contemporary Niebuhrians, is that the keen eye of the critic is turned on the beholder just as unsparingly as the beholden. So, I mean, it's fair to do a feminist critique of Niebuhr's theology. That was in the spirit of the guy. It's impossible to say, I think, how he would have responded to feminist critiques of his theology, but it's my conviction that his theological perspective is not undercut by feminist critiques. I think that if Niebuhr would have paid more attention to women, he probably would have had better theology, and it would have made more sense than it does. And I still think it makes a lot of sense if it includes some of this other experience. He does have a kind of a significant section in The Nature and Destiny of Man that I guess I kind of read over the first time and never really caught, but it's in there. Let me just share a little bit of it. He's very much into, some of you, when you read this section, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but some of you when you read it will say, well, Niebuhr was really into motherhood. He really felt that was one thing that really defined women. And he says, a rationalistic feminism is undoubtedly inclined to transgress inexorable bounds set by nature. Now, some people wouldn't agree with that. On the other hand, he says, any premature fixation on certain historical standards in regard to the family will inevitably tend to reinforce male arrogance and to retard justified efforts on the part of the female to achieve such freedom as is not incompatible with the primary function of motherhood. The freedom, which is the unique capacity of humankind, makes it difficult to set precise standards for all kinds, for any kind of relationship, including the relationship of the sexes. Because the sinfulness of man, on the other hand, makes it inevitable that a dominant class, group, or sex should seek to define a relationship which guarantees its dominance as permanently normative. What he was saying is that, you know, men have an advantage in defining the relationship between men and women, and they're going to define it in a way that they always end up being preeminent and women always end up being subservient. Like I say, he didn't pay a whole lot of attention to women's experience, but he paid enough attention to what was going on around him to know that there was a tendency among folks to try to, you know, pull rank on other people, and he could see that men tried to pull rank on women. So there's some hope for the guy, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. Let me stop there and see what you think of all that. Yes.
Plaskow's criticism is precisely why the discipline of women's studies has developed in all areas, because academics have felt that seems true in everything, from the topic of women's experience, literature, brothers, et cetera.
Sure.
And it's only by beginning to concentrate on those things, and we will eventually be able to create some disciplines that include everybody.
Sure. I mean, that's the point, I guess, is that, but what's happened is that, it's like those studies that Some of you may be familiar with a book by a woman named Carol Gilligan called In a Different Voice. And you know, one of the things that she was associated with a guy named Kohlberg, who did a bunch of studies on moral development in people. You know, how do people develop morally and how do they make decisions? And she was working for Kohlberg, and at a certain point she figured out that all of the people that Kohlberg was testing to determine what human, you know, moral development was, they were all men. They were all male students. And, you know, it's a long process, but she got to wondering what would happen. And that kind of set the standard for, you know, what was good moral development and what wasn't good moral development. And it seemed like when you compared women to the test results that Kohlberg got, they always kind of came off second best as sort of morally deficient. So what she did is pursued this thing, and she found out that, at least according to her, that women have a different way of looking at moral issues than men do. And it's not that one is better than the other and one is deficient from the other. It's just that they have different ways of looking at those kinds of things and different ways of solving moral problems. Yeah, that probably should have been obvious to people, I guess, if we thought about it long enough, but it wasn't obvious to people. And you know, that's a real significant kind of a work because it's got all kinds of implications for education and for, you know, theology and how you raise kids. Okay.
I'm not so sure that it wasn't evident to a lot of people. I'm just not so sure that a lot of people cared.
Okay. You want to say a little more about that? I think I know.
Only that I remember the revelation after being married 19 years, after many, many years ago, I realized my wife can make major contributions to my life.
That wasn't
obvious. It was amazing to me. It really was. You know, my son would say quite awesome. But that's just the way I was raised. I mean, you know, it's just
you don't
like,
see it.
Boom, you know, yeah. It's like I got hit with a 2x4.
Okay.
I mean, it's not that I just didn't know any better, I guess.
Good. I got a question for you all, and some of you came in a little bit late, but one of the things we talked about is that whole role of experience in theology. You know, we said some people start with experience and some people start with revelation, but revelation is really somebody else's experience, okay? And folks that are in charge of things have a vested interest in making you think that their revelation is going to dictate what you ought to experience. That's a kind of a revolutionary notion when you start to think about the theological implications of that. And I guess I want to know how people respond to that here. What do you think of that idea of revelation as being, you know, somebody's experience that happened a long time ago that gets codified and somehow legitimized? Did that bother anybody? Or maybe not. Yeah.
Well, I do think it's women are out of line. And I've experienced that.
Have you been out of line?
Well, I'm not a traditional thinker. I'm not a status quo thinker necessarily. And therefore, you know, I lost people all the time. But on the other hand, I still am very biblical oriented.
Okay.
I don't depart too much from what I see in scriptures, and I don't necessarily think that they have to be interpreted in a traditional way. That doesn't mean that I don't value scripture or what it says and what God is speaking to us through it. I just think that sometimes man puts God in a box and says, this is what God means when he says this, whereas maybe we haven't viewed it from other perspectives that should be in consideration.
Okay, thanks. Yeah. Joe, you were going to say something.
I'm trying to recall. Well, just that I think that the way you put it in some way understates the problem, John.
Okay.
That saying that you've got one set of experiences that define Reinhold Niebuhr's perspective as a powerful male in the culture, and another set of experiences, which are women's experiences, sort of make an equality that isn't there.
Okay.
It really isn't there. Reinhold Niebuhr's experience has had the weight of hundreds of years of Western European imbued values and norms mm-hmm. that define not only his experience, mm-hmm. but partly define what it is women experience in the culture, okay. right? So yeah. we're sort of talking experience
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
versus experience.
Yeah.
You know?
yeah.
Or something that is not valid, or at least doesn't have the aspect of choice about it.
Okay.
You know?
Okay.
So that when you're dealing, and choice is so important to you,
uh-huh.
you get into trouble, I think, just listening in the last half
mm-hmm.
hour,
mm-hmm.
with, for instance, a category like the sins of sensuality,
mm-hmm.
because you don't, you get very close to blaming the victim.
Okay.
You get very close to defining sin as being oppressed,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Rather than understanding, I think,
mm-hmm.
the real kind of imperial nature of the experience
mm-hmm.
which Niebuhr speaks from,
mm-hmm.
you know, as opposed to feminist theology.
Okay, I think you're right. I mean, I accept that too. And I guess, well, that's a good point, I think. It's an essential point.
I think extraordinarily complex because we're still even now talking about two voices, even if one is
mm-hmm.
much more heavily weighted than the other. When somebody masqueraded as an old woman, it was about being old as well as about being a woman and what it means that we refuse to use those lenses. There's this guy in New York, the head of a foundation, who is at various times masqueraded as a garbage collector.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He was a homeless person.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a homeless person. He did very well because he masqueraded as a homeless person living in front of his own building. But so disguised that the people that knew him didn't recognize him. And when he was interested in his health, they treated him the same person. Now that he didn't recognize him, they treated him as a street person.
Mm-hmm.
He goes on at great length. At great embarrassment to them, and he didn't mean to embarrass them. It's not. It's about a whole category of people who are excluded,
mm-hmm.
but they're also excluded, and that's a whole dimension in what it pertains to. I mentioned yesterday when I was talking about this on being sane in insane places, where people who were professional people put themselves in mental hospitals as if they were ill, but they weren't,
mm-hmm.
and everything they did was regarded as a sign of their pathology.
Mm-hmm.
And but there were these very interesting things you don't think about, like nurses in the company in a room full of grown men who would adjust their blouse, because as far as they were concerned, these weren't adult men they were with. These were pathetic creatures who were in mental hospitals. And all these dimensions that don't enter into the way in which we think about the world make it very difficult to decide how you proceed from here. It isn't as if we now know what these different voices are, but how does one move from there to policy? It's
right.
a very tough question. I mean, that's what strikes me as very, this revelation is it's an aha experience. It happened once and everything is different.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we have now a series of books about aha experiences which come and go,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
with very little influence on how things are manifest themselves in our institutions. Because if you can't do it with one person and then move on. We have lots of women in universities who I think are equally competent not getting tenure,
mm-hmm.
because we don't have the institutional strategies for making sure that they have the kind of support systems available to them
mm-hmm.
when the time comes to make decisions about how to organize one's career that were available to me
mm-hmm.
when I went about organizing my career.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't just say women have an equal opportunity. You also can't just say that it's something we now fully understand. You must use that as a you somehow have to use that to develop a mechanism
mm-hmm.
to ground the way in which you proceed so the weight begins to shift. It's a hard problem.
Well, if I
can
think that on that, the other thing that seems to me is you can't just say it's women's sin that they don't claim their freedom and
mm-hmm.
assert themselves
mm-hmm.
because of this question of the weight on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can't just keep asserting yourself and asserting yourself and asserting yourself without props and
mm-hmm.
without those other supports. I have some sense of what it is, the advantage that men have,
mm-hmm.
having spent 3 years in Nigeria as an educated white person.
I mean, in that country, I got the advantages, and some of the disadvantages, but mostly the advantages, because I would go there, and people would, I mean, while I was there, they would treat me differently, but in an advantage way. I mean, they would, I'd go into the post office, there'd be 200 people in line, and they would signal to me to come to the front. Mm-hmm. And I didn't do it for sort of obvious reasons. Or they would want me to use a different bathroom. Or there were all kinds of things that were, where I saw suddenly how an advantaged person gets treated. And it was, I mean, there has to be this support system that Andy talked about.
Okay. I appreciate that. I guess I want to come... I want to come back to, though, to the question that I started off asking you, which was, you know, the notion of revelation as being, you know, somebody's experience. I mean, part of the weight that makes that such an uneven thing is the weight of scripture and tradition and theological studies through the years, you know, the whole religious weight. I mean, let's not talk about the economic and political and all that stuff. Okay, all of that, but let's just focus on that one thing, on the weight of Scripture. If we start to do the kind of thing that Rosemary Ruther is talking about, which is to do a radical critique on that, you know, revelation, what one of the things that starts to do is it starts to undercut some of the weight that's holding folks in place. You know, it's one of the things that legitimate the system that makes some people more equal than others, in this case, men more equal than women. And that's why I think, you know, that's, you know, feminist biblical studies are some of the most revolutionary. I mean, things are going to get set on their ear, you know, and I don't think people even realize how radical a change we're talking about. Some of the biblical studies. Elizabeth Fiorenza's got a book called In Memory of Her, which kind of goes through the New Testament and sort of demythologizes the scriptural passages, the household tables, and this whole structure. You know, that is one of the things I think that helps to undercut that experience. You know, maybe experience really isn't so. So hallowed, it's got holes in it, you know, and that's, I think that's what's significant about that. So your point's well taken, but I think there's, you know, in terms of what Ruther is talking about, it helps to undercut some of that and get at some of that tradition that keeps things the way they are, because that's the way they always have been, because that's the way God wants it, you know. Well, maybe God didn't want it that way. Bob.
I find her book not really to be one that sets aside what we might call biblical experience.
Mm-hmm. But Ruther, you're talking about now. Yeah.
I think Ruther and Phyllis Trimble and others aren't setting aside biblical experience. I think they're setting aside biblical interpretations that were based on male experience.
Mm-hmm.
They're really going back to the text and saying, well, now, wait a minute, what does the text say?
Mm-hmm.
And if we listen to the text, and not to what men are interpreting the text to say, we hear something all we gotta do. So there's still a dialogue between the individual and the community. There's still the dialogue between my experience and biblical experience,
mm-hmm.
but biblical experience now heard afresh, heard anew.
I think that's right. I think the other aspect of what Ruther's doing is she's saying, how is it that we happen to get the text that we got? You know, what was the selection process that determined that this text was in and this text was out? Now, we have some notion of how that worked, but, you know, were there other kinds of criteria that we're not real aware of? And so she's even asking, in a sense, she's asking us to take another look at how we got what we got. You know, how did it get to us? And that's a pretty...
In part, you know, when we look at what we got,
mm-hmm.
we only look at part of it. We look at the stories that reinforce what we want. And so
sure.
Someone like Phyllis Trouble said, hey, look at all these texts over here that
mm-hmm.
are in the Bible, and they are about women, and they
mm-hmm.
are about women's experiences, and how come they are not in the lectionary?
Yeah.
You know, so there's a lot of stuff that is there in the text.
Yeah.
We look at it.
That we, Others.
Was the development of that experience in its direction intentional, do you think?
You mean in terms of, I'm not sure I understand.
Well, in regards to the male direction.
The selection of the text?
Rather than including the female aspect of it, was it intentional or was it just...
I guess I'm not prepared to say. There are some people that say it was intentional. You know, there's a lot of people that say it was intentional and it was conscious. I'm not sure. You know, it's hard to say. You know, but there are people that would say that it was intentional. In the book In Memory of Her, Fiorenza says yes, it was intentional that the household tables that kind of keep women in their place, you know, found their way into the New Testament. You know, that it was an attempt by the church to structure its life in a certain way that did not threaten the society around it, as opposed to the way some churches were structured, in which there was more of a charismatic, egalitarian kind of a system. And so she's making a case for the fact that it was intentional. You know, other people I think would have trouble, you know, making that kind of a case for any number of reasons. But you know, that's an open question, I think. You know, but that's an important one, I think. Yeah.
I was going to say, in Genesis 2, you know, the studies of that, I think, maybe are an example of what you're saying. For so long, you know, we learned that in the creation story, and God mm-hmm. created man, and now the word is God created human.
Right.
It gives it such a different,
sure.
you know, feeling than man.
Yeah.
And that, going back to having someone look at the text anew, mm-hmm. with different eyes.
Sure.
The other area where I think a lot of work has been done is with fairy tales. The women's interpretations that have come out of fairy mm-hmm. tales now.
I'm not familiar with that, but...
We're up there talking, I can't remember the name of it. I'll try and come up with it.
Sure.
A couple of years
yeah.
ago. And at the same time was when Bruno
Bettelheim
wrote his book.
Yeah,
there
yeah.
was one put out by a Catholic priest. I can't think of her name, but her, and I've read it several times mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. I loved it. It
yeah.
from a woman's point of view, interpretation uh-huh. of the
character. Well, good. Thank you for that. Yeah, if you think of the name of it, I'd like to know, and maybe some of these folks would too. More. Bob.
Yeah, you were mentioning about household tables.
Yeah.
I wanted to put a plug in for Fiorenza's book, In Memory of Her.
Uh-huh.
Because...
That's in a bookstore, by the way.
Yeah. Try to... Let's say, I didn't hear Dan Erlander's Ephesians 5 thing and why it shouldn't be read at weddings.
Yeah, okay.
I'll have to check it out on the tape.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you get this passage of wives shall love their husbands and husbands will take care of their wives and that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And if we look at that, and if we freeze it the way it is,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's one kind of an interpretation
mm-hmm.
which can certainly support some kind of a male dominance.
Sure.
But... if it's read, and this is what I mean by reading the text afresh, if it's heard in its own setting, that's got to be one of the most radical statements in the whole New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it certainly is up there with the top. Because in that culture, you know, if you think divorce is convenient and quick and easy now, it was that fast
mm-hmm.
then. If wifey burnt the toast in the morning, you know, hubby writes out a little note and she's out on the street. She's divorced. That's it. I mean, that's all it takes. And on the street, a woman's survival is pretty well limited to being a prostitute.
Mm-hmm.
So a woman would live in fear of offending her husband in that kind of setting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so to love, you know, that's really radical stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that whole section begins by an equalitarian statement of husbands and wives love each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that's on par. And then... it slips back when it starts to delineate
sure.
that, but it started out on a par, and that is absolutely unheard of in that setting. I mean, that's totally radical literature.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if that statement is seen as the beginning of a trajectory about that has something to
okay.
say about relationships, then we don't have to freeze it in flight, but we can say, given this culture, how do we continue that kind of a trajectory about how people relate to people? And then, you know, we're way beyond some kind of codified household structure.
Okay.
And, you know, we just keep moving that trajectory on. keep working it towards the beginning line of that whole passage.
On the basis of our experience. I'm going to stop there. Thank you.